You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout.
From New York City, it's the Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles. I still
remember. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knowles. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to take a look today at some very important issues. First of all, on health and nutrition. We're going to look at PBSs that are in our environment. They're in all kinds of plastics and what they do to our brain. And then we're going to take a look at a new report out of France shows that the French oak wood extract is great for the liver. Since there's a lot of liver disease in the United States, this should be good. And also, there's a supplement that has been discovered to be better than anything else for helping post-traumatic stress disorder, University of South Carolina, and a lot more on health and healing. Then I'm going to do a series of short newsmaker pieces. I'm going to look at the U.S. officials now state that Israel spying on America has reached, quote, terrifying levels. So, if of all the nations in the world, including Russia and China, Israel's doing more spying on us, why isn't ever mentioned? Why is there no criticism ever leveled against Israel for spying? And what could they be using that information for? We'll deal with that. Also, how much money have we spent on wars since 2001? I'm going to tie several things together. I'm going to give you an idea what it is to be a person living in their car that's the new normal. I want to take you through a day in their life. And then I also want you to see how many people are likely going to be living in their cars or outside of home because they're not going to have a home, couldn't afford a home. And I'm going to tie in the numbers. And when you see the numbers, you should ask yourself, why isn't anyone in the mainstream media discussing this? But we will. A special commentary from Professor Henry Juro, Militant Hope in the Age of the Politics of Disconnect, from Counterpunch. Also from Jeffrey Sachs, the Boston Globe, The Fatal Expense of American Imperialism. Also, they finally came up with what was the role of David Cameron when it came to Libya and the collapse of Libya that we see now today as a failed state. Well, a panel from the British government, official panel, has finally finished their work, and I'll tell you what they have to say about that. Also today, I'm going to set some time aside, not have a guest, because I want to deal with something I hear all the time. I'm out and traveling, finishing filming now, and someone was talking about all progressives, but everything they were saying had nothing to do with progressives. So I'm going to define in a commentary progressive values, liberal values, conservative values, socialist values, and the distinctions between them, and then give you some real examples of what those of us who are independent, we're not Republican, we're not Democrat, and we are the majority, by the way, we're over 47%, what do we have to do for our voices to be heard and for our energies to be impacted? I'll give you that agenda as well. Plus today, we're going to hear from what it means, this is in London, and the camera, you can only hear the audio part, but what you're going to see is a report on a homeless person and what it means to be homeless today. And we had to edit it because there were a lot of expletives in it. Then we're going to take a look at how they're trying to make CBD oil a class one drug. And that's the DEA. We know about what is in cannabis oil. We know how many scientific studies exist supporting it. Then why are they doing that? We'll tell you their motive. Also today, from Jimmy Dore of the Young Turks, a message to Barack Obama. It's about time someone talked out, said it. You'll hear it. And then, for those who thought you were getting the truth on what was going on in Syria, there's a big scramble for oil there now. You'll never guess who's behind the company that Israel has given exclusive rights to dig for oil in the Golan Heights. But hold on, the Golan Heights is Syrian. You can't go in there unless you're from the Syrian government and dig. Yes, you can, if you're arrogant, if you don't give a damn about what anyone thinks, and you can do anything you want if you have the power. But that's only because people don't know what you're doing. The abuse of power frequently can change people's perceptions of you using that power. So we're going to share that with you if time permits. As you see, we have a full agenda. So let's go through everything that's important on the areas of health and nutrition. And I always try to find studies that we haven't seen or heard reported anywhere else. For example, from the University of Massachusetts, plastics have chemicals. These chemicals can alter our hormones. And in the first study of its kind, environmental health scientist Professor Laura Vanderberg and neuroscientist Mary Cantese at the University of Massachusetts examined the effects of the compound BPS, that's a biphenyl chemical, on maternal behavior and related brain regions in this study, laboratory study, and they found subtle but striking behavioral changes from the mother and then through the pregnancy. What this boils down to is that we have lived for at least the last 100 years with various chemicals ever more increasing into our lifestyle. We think nothing at all about taking something out of a microwave and eating it, not realizing that if there's aluminum in there or plastics like these PVCs or the PBSs, they'll leach out into the food. But then again, we have so downplayed because of industry control over the media, they don't want to tell us the full truth. They haven't told us the truth in 100 years about cigarette smoking. We had to find that out by a whistleblower. Yet the government knew the truth and kept it its proprietary secret. It felt that was more important than the about 20 million Americans who had died over the previous century from tobacco-related illnesses. So when you're using all these plastics, understand that there is a problem, especially when it gets hot. So now they're showing that one way that it can interfere in the body, it can go to your brain, and that can cause problems. So as often as possible, use glass, use ceramic, use stainless steel, but stay away from things that get hot and can leach. From the D'Annunzio University in Italy, they found that a supplement made from an extract of French oak wood would support liver function by boosting the elimination of toxins. It was only 300 milligrams of this particular French oak wood extract used daily for 12 weeks, and it created a substantially increased improvement. Now, this was from alcohol-related liver damage. We're talking about huge numbers of people worldwide have alcohol liver damage. In the United States, probably 20% of all college and university students do. So read up on it. Now you know it exists. And that's how everything starts. It starts by hearing something. So write it down. The researchers found the ingredient. It's a water extract from the Quercus, Quercus, robur species, R-O-B-U-R, that are grown substantially in the forest in this particular part of central region in France. So there's good studies on it now, and it's in the scientific literature, so you can get it. And it was published in a peer-reviewed journal. From the University of South Carolina, a new study coming out, shows extensively promising results for a new treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse, all substances. And they're calling it a pharmaceutical intervention. It's actually not a pharmaceutical intervention because it's a completely natural product. And those of us in the health movement have been using it with people that we counsel for a long time. This is N-acetylcysteine, N-A-C. N-acetyl, A-C-E-T-Y-L, acetylcysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E. And when you combine this with cognitive behavioral therapy, you had a tremendous improvement in people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's important. And it's much better than any of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that I do not recommend people use. Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor. I would stay away from all those. So now if you know anyone who's got addictive problems, because going clear back to when I was at the Institute of Applied Biology, across the street from the Institute was Trafalgar Hospital. And I also did a lot of work over there in dietetics and in nutrition research. But they had a department where you had a choice. You could either do methadone treatment or you'd go to jail if you were a drug addict. And so I said the methadone is really not a whole lot better than heroin. There's a better way. And so I started showing them this other way I'd come up with. And N-acetylcysteine was a part of it. There were other nutrients also, but that helped them get off the substances without going completely into an extreme agitated state. From the University of Florida, exercise may be real medicine for Parkinson's disease. And almost any exercise is good medicine for someone with Parkinson's disease. There's a new study that shows this. Now, although physical activity may seem impossible for some Parkinson's patients, the new research review reaffirms what many specialists already believe, that exercise can have a long-term impact, improving gait and reducing risk of falls in particular. Quote from the study that was published through the chairman of the neurology department at University of Florida. I pretty much never see a Parkinson's disease patient without recommending an exercise. And then he goes on to talk about how there's over 100 studies over the last 30 years that proves exercise is important. So that's the approach one of the approaches I would take. Also from Johns Hopkins University, researchers add to the evidence that common bacteria cause of gum disease may also be responsible for a lot of rheumatoid arthritis. So investigators at Johns Hopkins report they have new evidence that a bacterium known to cause chronic inflammatory gum infections also triggers the inflammatory autoimmune response characteristic of chronic joint-destroying rheumatoid arthritis. So, and this was published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Here's something that is important. Get yourself in the hands of a holistic dentist. Let them do the examination of your gums, your teeth, and then get a good cleaning. And they have techniques now that can get the bacteria killed inside the gums, both internally and through the different techniques that are being used. And that'll make a big difference. But people frequently don't do anything about their gums. When their gums are beginning to recede, they don't do anything about it. They don't do proper flossing. They don't do water picking. They don't do proper agitation with lightly of a toothbrush. Plus, on top of that, they frequently suffer from decalcification because they're not adequate in the combination of minerals necessary to remineralize the bone. And then they don't use the right kind of mouthwash. They're using alcohol in a mouthwash. You should never use alcohol in a mouthwash. And because that's only going to kill bacteria for a very short period of time. But then it also changes the whole pH in the mouth. And the essential oils are what you need. and those essential oils inside the mouth, those will also help. And they also have some new research from the Salk Institute published in the journal Cell. Quote, aging may not have to proceed in one single direction. Quote, our study shows that aging may not have to proceed in one single direction. It has plasticity, and with careful modulation, aging might be reversed. Well, they're working in one direction, what are known as the Yamamaka factors, the four genes known as that, using stem cell. But I've seen remarkable improvements and reversal of aging by overcompensating. What I mean is this. I call this the laws of overcompensating, meaning to the degree that you have anything wrong with you, bacterial, viral, trauma, genetic, injury, you're toxic, you have to exceed the genetic expression. So most of the time we do just the opposite. So let's say we're sick and we're told just to get rest and drink water. Okay. But we're not really doing anything out of taking the medications. The medications are principally meant to damp down some of the symptoms so we're more comfortable. Whereas what got us to where the disease was now manifesting as a dominant energy in the body, possibly threatening to take our life, is that we had paid no attention to everything going in has a purpose. And in time, if you continue to pollute the body, just like water, in time the water is simply undrinkable. But it didn't just happen overnight. It takes time for this to happen. Unless it's a spill, then yeah. So you have to start flooding the body with healing nutrients. But it's not just the nutrients. And here's where science, being very monotheistic and refusing to accept interconnectivity, doesn't understand. It's not just the nutrients like a vitamin C in an orange or beta-carotene in some kale. It's also the energy, because everything in life is an exchange of energy, and that energy is either constructive or destructive by measure. For example, if you're drinking a glass of gin, you're not going to end up the next day with cirrhosis of the liver. If you have one hamburger, you're not going to end up with a heart attack. If you have one teaspoon of sugar, you're not going to end up with diabetes. But continue doing that every day, and it is inevitable that the most vulnerable system will break down first, but then right behind that are all these other systems. So that is, you're giving no good energy to the body. You're giving bad energy, and hence the body's still trying to fight on your behalf, but you're not helping it. And when was the last time we saw people actively help prevent anything? Prevent their government from collapsing into authoritarian, totalitarian police state. We haven't. We've actually done everything to make sure that it goes smoothly. As long as the fascist is someone we like, you know, Barack Obama, perfect. Couldn't be any better. Hillary Clinton, she's also a good fascist in her role model, but there's a whole group of people who believe in her because they're members of a cult. And as a result, they refuse to look at any of her actual historical references, what she's done to her people. A feminist who says, my whole group supporting Hillary. Why? Well, because Hillary supports women? Okay. Let me show you the millions of women who've died or suffered, or children have died and suffered because of Hillary. Then when you talk with those women and you go to their villages and you see the decapitations and you see the mutilations and you see the rapes and you see the poverty and you see everything that these women and their children once enjoyed, and all that was done by Hillary Clinton. Bill's kind of a dodo. He's just looking where he can get himself distracted in the next 5 minutes. She's very smart. Smart enough to have one of the most important movements that would have been absolutely unmitigatingly disastrous, but there wouldn't have been a single complaint in the entire liberal media about it, as there weren't any complaints about another $1 trillion for nukes or invading Libya or invading Syria. In fact, many on the left, including Pacifica, support that. Where's the call out to those people? Oh, we don't do that. You don't attack on any level the legitimacy? Why is there some goddess principle that I have been informed of? I see. Mindlessness. That's a good excuse. That I could accept. Because the more you look at something, the closer you look at something, the more it reveals itself. So as long as we live in the fog of illusion, we never have to get close enough to the examples that might have an impact upon us. So that's what we're dealing here in this whole idea. Don't look close enough at what you're doing. You say it's the holidays, or say it's a birthday, or say it's, I can't eat healthy when I'm out with my friends. Keep giving yourself excuses. And you win. You absolutely win. You're just not going to like your reward for what you won. So that's how we are as a society today. We didn't get here by accident. I'll deal with that a little later. So if you want to reverse it, you have to do just the opposite. You have to put your energy into empowering your thoughts, empowering your perception, empowering your capacity for judgment that is based upon reasonable, intuitive insight instead of pure, raw, epigenetically gut-motivated reaction. Because when we're reacting, we suspend reason. And most of all, people simply react. So then when you put everything that heals, everything that calms, everything that soothes, everything that energizes, everything that empowers into your mind and your body, you then exceed the energy that was in the disease state, and suddenly the disease goes down and the healing energy goes up. So that's a very brief overview of what happens when you're working on the healing energy instead of the diseasing energy. By the way, the same principle applies to all social institutions as well. And if you doubt me, look at people who have handing out the Mao's handbook of social, you know, adjustment and confrontation from 1968 as if this is what we got to do today if we want change. No. Nope. Just be careful about what you're doing with your revolution, because we want our listeners to be this. You succeeded. We want our ideologues to be powerful in that, and you got that. They're there. And we're not going to alter one iota, not one millimeter of our capacity for reason. Gotcha. So you won. Now you're not happy with no audience, no funding, no management, very little good broke, and total complete chaos. But everyone who never had to have a background in the field now is an expert in how to do it. Boy, that's like saying, what, I got cancer? You got terminal cancer. In the brain? Well, in the brain, the heart, the liver, the lungs. It's all over. Okay, only one thing I could do. I've got to get something that's going to increase the spread. What's your logic there? Well, and there is none. But they all think they've got it. Good for them. As the world just goes by, someone's just going to turn off the lights sooner or later, and they'll run around punching each other in the face in their anger. But they wouldn't have to have the lights out to do that. They do it every day on the Good Light Board. God, just pathetic. Ashwagandha root and leaf extract quells knee pain in a study. From the NISAM's Institute of Medical Science in India, quote, a study done with ashwagandha extract on knee pain opens up a new category for the botanical, joint health. So for any of you who have joint health out there, this wonderful Ayurvedic herb, ashwagandha, A-S-H-W-A-G, W-A-G-A-N-D-A, A-N-D-H-A, root and leaf extract is good for your joint pain. And finally, what we're seeing now is that more people are getting more sicknesses in America than ever before. With all the books, videos, specials, programs. So this isn't about more information. We've got information junkies who are still making almost every choice they make in unhealthy ways. We got to get to what's behind all this. And I'm setting aside on New Year's Day for just a special on a dealing with where we should point ourselves in the new year. I'm Gary Noll. George Michael passed. A lot of you came to our dance parties over the years, and thank you, by the way, for all of you who in the last year have been sending us videos that you took. We're editing them together to share them with you, and because we have 50 of them over 35 years, and I'll do some more in the spring. George Michael was one of the people you would hear some of his music being played. So this is just today, our little sound clips are to honor him. I'd like to welcome you from all over the United States and all around the world who are listening in right now. I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to tie several things together, just pieces of thread coming into little intellectual syntaxes for us to be able to focus for a moment. For example, North Dakota has now become the first state in the United States to legalize the use of armed drones on the public by the police. So look very soon for your local police departments to be using weaponized drone devices. So where's the outcry? Where's the demonstrations? Where's the editorials? They don't exist. So I guess it means it's okay. Because remember, any weapon America can create, it will always be used. We were the first to reach the atom bomb, and well, we sure showed the world we wanted to make sure no one else would use weapons of mass destruction, so we did, when it was completely unnecessary. It would not have in any way shortened the war with Japan. They had already were in a position to, and this was, by the way, borne out by later statements that were made by the former Rear Admirals and others top up in the policymaking positions. And we also used biological agents. We were giving them to Saddam Hussein. I wrote the article on that, was able to track those down, where they smuggled it through the Department of Agriculture. So I'm just thinking, where will it happen? Where will the first attack by a drone happen? Because every police department is going to want to be able to have a drone that's weaponized, because then it, you don't have to do the whole police chasing, and you don't have to stand there and shoot someone in the back of the head, even though they got handcuffs on with 47 bullets, and say you were terrified. You feel threatened. I'm sure you did. In which case, you should not be in that position of authority, but that's how dysfunctional our society is today. But just imagine what could happen when you get some people who are going to be using those drones on Americans. So that's coming at you. And then we turn around and we don't have a problem spending $5 trillion. This is according to Eric Levitz and the United States, $4.79 trillion and counting. This was done at Brown University's Watson Institute. And that does not include everything, but it includes much, but not everything. It's well over $6 trillion if you add up everything. So we got $6 trillion to spend. And here again is the question. Where were the protests? Where were the letter writing campaigns and the editorials and the demonstrations in front of Congress to keep that money from being appropriated? To give the Halliburtons and the other warmongers, and I've mentioned this many times, there are over 200,000 companies that did support Hillary Clinton. And they would have been very happy because we had big wars, hot wars, on almost a definite certainty with Israel being given the wink and the nod to go ahead and blow Iran to pieces, even though Iran does not have contrary to the people making claims about, oh, we got to get them before they're fully weaponized. There's no way in the world they're weaponizing. They're watched every day, 24 hours a day, with cameras from the National Atomic Energy Commission and our Nuclear Energy Commission that is has locks, keys, and inspectors on a regular basis. But the truth doesn't seem to matter to either side anymore. But we had the money. And then here's where they're putting $1.5 trillion. And by the way, where was the protest? Quote, this is from Global Research, Manlio Danusi. After 4 years of design and testing, the NNSA, and by the way, that's the National Nuclear Security Administration, through the Military Application of Nuclear Science project, has greenlit the engineering phase of the mass production of weapons. Now, these are not just any weapons. These are new nuclear weapons and a whole new type. And if anyone lets you think that they're not that, well, they're not that deadly. They are, each one of them has the power of three atomic bombs they drop in Hiroshima. The many components of the B-61-12 are designed and tested in national laboratories at Los Alamos, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Livermore, California, and produced using parts of the B-61 in a series of plants in Missouri, Texas, South Carolina, and Tennessee. Well, what does that tell us? And by the way, we're producing 400 to 500 bombs. We're dealing in billions of dollars, and we'll start getting them within another year or two with full mass production by 3 years from now. Once again, what they produce, they now can use. And when you have people who have split-trigger temperaments and temper tantrums, that is bad. But the moment they tell me where they're produced, then I can look quickly and see that the countries who are going to hold these forces would be Belgium and the Netherlands, Germany, Turkey, Italy, they're all getting paid to have these 70 nuclear bombs in Italy, 50 nuclear bombs in another area of Italy, 50 bombs in Turkey, 20 in Germany, Belgium and Netherlands, for a total of 180 nuclear weapons just there. No one knows how many there have, but they're capable of doing what is called bunker bombing. They can go several hundred feet down and destroy anything that anyone's been able to build underground. But that means that the legislators and the employees in those states where they're being made are not going to want to lose their jobs. So the idea is keep our jobs, and we won't talk about the moral implications of what we're producing with those jobs. I think we should be talking about that so that we can turn around and ask, what else can we do in those plants to change it over from making weapons of mass destruction to something that's peaceful that we can use in our own societies to help us? And this is a little piece I thought you would find of interest. This is short from Zero Hedge. Dear Obama, how does a 60% increase in New York City homelessness constitute a recovery? Last week, we wrote a post entitled Harvard Crushes the Obama Recovery Farce with 9 simple charts, in which we reviewed a report from Harvard Business School on the true health of the U.S. economy. Given the title, it's probably not terribly surprising that Harvard was somewhat underwhelmed with the Obama recovery after taking a multi-decade look at various economic metrics, like labor force participation and new businesses, to come up with this. So here's one message. Right now, we have a 60% increase in New York City homelessness, and they're not giving you all the right numbers. Every day that I walk through Manhattan, I see homeless people at night living in doorways, in bank cash takeout rooms where they just go in because it's warmer. They're only counting shelters. So they're not giving us the true amount. This is from Mike Snyder. He says, as the middle class has shrunk and the cost of living has increased, a lot of people have decided to quite literally live on the road, whether it's in a car, a truck, a van, a bus, or an RV, an increasing number of Americans are using their vehicles as their homes. Just recently, someone that I know took a trip down the west coast of the United States and stayed at a number of campgrounds along the way. What he discovered was that a lot of people were actually living at these campgrounds, not just staying there for a day or two. Earlier this week, Circa.com posted a story about the van life. One of the individuals they featured was a recent graduate of the University of Southern California named Stephen Hutchins. Without much of an income at the moment, he decided the best way to cut expenses was to live in his van. The main insurances are insurance for the van, $60 a month, and that's a big savings over living in an apartment. Of course, he showers in the gym, cooks on a portable stove on a sidewalk. He stores his butane at his friend's place nearby and uses Wi-Fi at nearby coffee shops. Sadly, just like during the last economic crisis, many Americans are getting to the point where staying in their homes may not be an option. And then it goes on to talk about, quote, an article from last week, the terrifying signs of a looming housing crisis. And it goes on. But here are the statistics you should really focus on. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the percentage of the total U.S. adult population that has a full-time job has been hovering around 48% since 2010. This is the lowest full-time employment level since 1983. The number of publicly listed companies trading on U.S. exchanges has been cut by almost 50% in the past 20 years, from 7,300 to 3,700. And new business startups are at a historical low. Americans have stopped starting businesses, and the businesses that do start are growing at historically slow rates. Well, that begs the question, once there was an opportunity for a lot of growth in the United States and starting your own business, what happened? Well, what happened was consolidation, outsourcing, and making it to where you're using such cheap labor that Americans couldn't compete. And that also with the all of the favors going in the direction of the major corporations and none going towards the workers. So that's where we're at. But I want to tell you what it means to be a small business person. How many small businesses do you think there are? Well, the last true count was in the neighborhood of 543,000 new businesses get started each month. But there's more businesses closing each month. And about 10 to 12% of firms with employees open each year, and a little more than that close. And that means that we have about 27 to 20 million small businesses, but we have 18,500 firms with 500 employees or more. The small business person is anyone who has one employee up to 20. And yet they employ over 50% of all working Americans. That's 120 million people work in a small business. So when was the last time you heard people advocating for small businesses? You don't. Helping them so they're not paying impossible rents. You don't. Because the average person just doesn't care. You walk up the street. If the business has been there for 30 years and no longer there because they can't afford the rent, another business will open up, take its place. But take a look at what's opening: drugstores, banks, mall stores. We are seeing the evisceration of small businesses, certainly in metropolitan areas. And yet they employ over 50% of all Americans. So if you don't pay attention to something and it's being adversely affected, you're going to end up with some serious problems. That brings me to something I think we... Oh, and by the way, finally, David Cameron, quote, is ultimately responsible for Libya's collapse and the rise of ISIS. This is from the Commons report. And thank goodness it's finally official. So now no one has to be called a conspiracy nut or say, oh, you're just, you know, you're saying something ideological instead of something true. This, I'm quoting, quote, the bloody collapse of Libya, which triggered a refugee crisis and aided in the rise of ISIS, is blamed today on David Cameron's blunders when he intervened to overthrow Colonel Gaddafi, A damning report by MPs condemned the 2011 military campaign for lacking both accurate intelligence and information to make appropriate decisions. The disastrous results were, quote, political and economic collapse, tribal warfare, the refugee crisis, widespread human rights abuses, and the rise of ISIS in North Africa, fueled by weapons abandoned by the Gaddafi regime. So, Cameron would not have made his move had it also not been for Hillary Clinton. And Clinton couldn't have made the move without Obama and without the full power of NATO behind it. The United States stands at the endpoint of a long series of attacks on democracy, and the choices faced by the American public today point to the divide between those who are committed to democracy and those who are not. Debates over whether Donald Trump was or is a fascist, or Hillary Clinton was a right-wing warmonger and tool of Wall Street, are simply tactical diversions. The real questions should have been debated, such as, what measures could have been taken to prevent the United States from sliding further into a distinctive form of authoritarianism? And what could have been done to imagine a mode of civic courage and militant hope needed to enable the promise of a radical democracy? Such questions take on a significant urgency in light of the election of Donald Trump to the presidency, and under such circumstances, not only is the public in peril, it is on the brink of collapse as the economic, political, and cultural institutions necessary for democracy to survive are being aggressively undermined. Professor Henry Giroux, who you've heard on this program many times, who I have a lot of respect for, sees the problem in a way that I believe we all should put on his perceptive glasses. Why? Because large segments of the American public, especially minorities of class and color, have been written out of politics over what they view as a failed state and the inability of the basic machinery of government to serve their interest. As market mentalities and moralities tighten their grip on all aspects of society, democratic institutions and public spheres are being downsized, if not altogether disappearing. As these institutions vanish, from public schools to healthcare centers, there's also a serious erosion of the discourses of community and justice, of equality and public values, and of what is, well, I'll just call the common good. This grim reality has been called a failed society, a failure in the power of the civic imagination and political will in open democracy. And as the consolidation of power by the corporate and financial elite empties policies of merit into politics without any substance, the political realm emerges. What I see, what you are probably seeing, you're seeing a kind of a freak show. Monty Python, Kafka, and Aldous Huxley, all intertwined. With the election of Donald Trump, the savagery of neoliberalism, and it would have been identical with Clinton, has been intensified with the emergence at the highest levels of power of a toxic mix of anti-intellectualism, religious fundamentalism, nativism, and a renewed notion of American exceptionalism. I'll deal with that on tomorrow's program. Mainstream politics is now dominated by hard right extremists, even though they have been called progressives or liberals or Democrats, is irrelevant. They're not, as I will do a little bit later, show you what is a real liberal and what is a real conservative as compared to what we're seeing today. These are real extremists. They engage in the politics of shame. They've got poisonous, xenophobic ideas and the blunt, malicious tenets and practice of Islamophobia. So it's really irrelevant whether they're on a Trump ticket or some other ticket. The older political establishment calls for regime change and war are now supplemented by the discourse of state-sanctioned torture, armed ignorance, and a deep hatred of democracy. Neoliberalism, with its full-fledged assault on the welfare state and public goods, the destruction of the manufacturing sector, the complete dismissal of the small business sector, as I just mentioned, and a dramatic shift in wealth to the upper, very elite group, has destroyed the faith of millions, tens of millions of Americans in democracy itself, which lost its power to contain the rich and rule of financial capital. With the erosion of the societal contract and the increasing power of the rich to control both the commanding institutions of society and politics itself, democracy has lost any legitimacy as a counterweight to protect the ever-widening sphere of people considered vulnerable and disposable. The result has been that the dangerous door to neo-fascist appeals have gained more and more credence. The end result is that large portions of the American public have turned to Trump's brand of authoritarianism. The future looks bleak, especially for youth in neoliberal societies, as they are burdened with debt, dead-end jobs, unemployment, and if you're black and poor, the increasing possibility of being either incarcerated or shot. The United States has become a war culture. An immediate mass of forms of resistance and civil disobedience are essential if the planet and human life is to go on to survive, but it won't. Yeah, take a look. Stop for a moment. You'll say, yeah, but look at what happened in North Dakota. Yeah, the Native Americans from all over came together. Yes. And exactly which treaties are now going to be re-examined to see about giving them back their rights. But they have rights. They own their land. No, they don't. Their land is not owned by the Native Americans. It's held in trust. And why don't you take a look like what it's the alcoholism, the brutality, the privations to many of those people living on that land. So you had some young and idealistic people that went out to stand with him. At any given time, what did you have? As many as 3,000 or 4,000 out of a country of 330 million? You're dealing in thousandths of a percent. So what is the opportunity that's going to get the average person away from the computer, away from their job, away from their responsibilities, to commit to anything that would stop the machinery of totalitarianism? I don't believe it's possible. I believe that what is possible is for 100 million people who are completely disenchanted with the existing system who didn't vote, and for those people to begin to look to see what they no longer want to support, because the Achilles heel of all political movements is when people no longer trust them. You want to destroy a relationship? Take away trust. Everything's doable if you have trust. Nothing is sustainable if you don't. If you're a listener and you haven't gotten your premiums for a year or two, you're going to keep trusting? Or are you going to say, no, you got to regain my trust? But what if regaining trust is not in anyone's special interest or even in their mindset? Then whatever you coveted, whatever you had power over, you're going to lose completely and totally. That's how it works. That's what we're seeing. So the best thing that could happen is that the American public see the truth that they've misplaced their trust, and I believe that will show itself within the next 6 months. And then we will be able to task each of us to take our money out of their banks, stop eating their food, stop supporting their television, radio candidates. And that is where the primary paradigm shift will occur towards truly more progressive ideals. Then we have a chance. Because central to a viable notion of ideological and structural transformation is a refusal of the mainstream politics of disconnect. In its place is a plea for broader social movements and a more comprehensive understanding of politics in order to connect the dots between, or for instance, police brutality and mass incarceration on the one hand, and the diverse crisis producing massive poverty and the destruction of the welfare state and the assaults on the environment and workers and young people and women. How in the world can we as a society condemn anyone within a race if we have not seen what they look at each day when they awaken? If you're in a rat-strewn room, you don't have money for food, you're living in a crime-based neighborhood where gangs have taken the place of anyone who would have been there to encourage you earlier, and they're there to dominate you because society no longer wanted to put the resources where it was needed. But later on, when out of desperation, out of poor judgment, a person does make a bad move, Now you're all too willing to condemn that person for long and extended incarceration in a punishment machine without any hope, unless it's to the individual's motive, to rehabilitate themselves. And you're not talking about a few thousand or a few hundred thousand. You're talking about over 7 million people, each with family members. So you've just condemned over 30 million people because you weren't willing to take a moment in time to see what it's like to be in another person's shoes before you condemn them. So I believe that we have to do a little soul searching and look inside. And I believe we have to create our own progressive think tanks. There is no such thing as progressive think tank, progressive foundation. What are you talking about, Soros, Rockefeller? No, these are not. No, we need progressive social services. We need to produce culture apparatuses such as complete alternative media. And when we do that, and we show people, before you trust us, let us show you what we are about, who we are, what we're doing. Then you will have more people coming in to support that than you will have the capacity to fulfill their needs. That's how movements start. And that's where we have to go at this point. Struggles that take place in particular contexts must also be associated with similar efforts at home and abroad. For instance, the ongoing privatization of public goods, such as schools, can be analyzed within increasing attempts on the part of billionaires to eliminate the social state and gain control over commanding economic and cultural institutions in the U.S. At the same time, the modeling of schools after prisons can be connected to the ongoing criminalization of a wide range of everyday behaviors and the rise of the punishing state. And right now, all you have with anyone who gets into office are people who are empowered by punishment. Donald Trump would like nothing better than just to beat the out of every human being he can. He is one rageful, angry, narcissistic punk. But we all know that, don't we? But is Hillary Clinton any better? No. No. The fact that one is incapable of intelligent conversation and the other can have an intelligent conversation, but is a pathological liar, and yet that's why we haven't had a movement yet, because we've assumed that the only people to get the movement from are the so-called liberals coming from the so-called Democratic People's Party. Well, you've already sold out your unions, the membership has. You've sold out your environmental movement for the free market environmentalism of Al Gore. And let's all get on our private jets and fly around the world because we're really concerned about Leonardo DiCaprio being a model. My God, how pathetic have we become? Call it for what it is. We've got to step away, disconnect from everything we thought was on our behalf, because it's never been on our behalf. The only thing that's missing today is we're so close to it. We're like a person standing in the woods against a tree that a bear has come up on us and we're closing our eyes, but we can feel its breath as its jaws open. That is what the Democrat and Republican parties have become. Everything is based upon punishment from such self-righteous hypocrites. If that is what we want, then they're going to give it to us. Closing up here today, I want to share one piece. We'll go out with this. This is about talking on the street in front of a camera about a homeless person in Great Britain. See if this resonates with anything in the United States.
On any one night in England, 3,500 people are living rough on the street. Last year, 275,000 people approached their local authority for homeless assistance. That can't be right. Mental. That is 250,000 people who are that close to living rough on the streets, and 3,500 people who are actually living rough on the street. 124,000 children living in temporary accommodation. These stats are horrendous. Oh, here we go. I wonder what. Over half of homeless services have seen their funding cut in the last 5 years. 3,500 people. It's a societal failure, homelessness. It's one of the biggest indications that a society has failed, is people who are hungry, begging and sleeping on the streets. And yet we're encouraged to see homeless people as if they've somehow failed themselves. It's their fault. They haven't worked hard enough. Don't worry about it. It's not your fault. Look at him. He's pissed. It must be his fault. It must be his fault, because we live in a meritocracy where if you work hard enough, you will succeed, which, of course, is plainly bollocks. It's exactly the same way that we treat people on benefits. And then we kid ourselves that not only is it their fault, but somehow that they're dangerous. Even the language that we use, beggars operate in this, operate, white lightning mafia or something. The other one, don't encourage begging. What, by giving him 20p? I'm not encouraging it, but the guy wants a cup of tea or a ruck or something, all right? Don't encourage it. It's like don't feed the pigeons, vermin. Yeah, they're in embarrassment. I don't know, maybe it is encouraging it. Maybe there is a better way to help. And yes, some of them stink of piss. Do you know why they stink of piss? Because he pissed himself last Tuesday, and a hot shower and a change of clothes has yet to present itself. Okay, but I walk past him every day. He is literally and proverbially a bad smell. That madman's shouting at the pigeons again. Let's just take a look at that sentence, shall we? A grown man who is addicted to alcohol, who is mentally ill without a roof over his head, is shouting at the pigeons again. And yet I walk past him. Yet I live in a society where everyone walks past him. I live in a society where the government does nothing about it apart from cut funding. Why is a policeman or an ambulance not stopping and taking him somewhere safe and warm? A society doesn't work if one person is living rough on the street. It's morally bankrupt if this is normal and on the increase and getting worse. And if it's getting worse, it's more visible. And if it's more visible, I have to do more to try and ignore it to be able to get on with my day, which means I become part of the problem. Every day I walk past people who are cold and hungry and ill and homeless, and I don't stop and give them everything I have. Shame on me. Sleeping rough has doubled since 2010. Doubled! I mean, have you seen it? I've noticed it. Have you noticed? I've noticed. It's doubled. Hang on a minute. Did I not just say that homelessness services have been halved, and yet homelessness has doubled? The funding's halved and the problem's doubled. It's almost like those two statistics are related somehow, isn't it?
I was particularly taken by something you said, and that was that to have one homeless person sleeping on the street shows the failure of society. We should reflect upon that if we believe we are a society. But then if we are a society, how do we allow 28 million Americans, 7 million homes to be foreclosed on, and not one single time did we as a nation come together and say, this is not right, the bank should not have this power, the government is giving the power, you're not putting any of the bankers in jail, they did all this wrong, they're paying fines, but they're putting people out of their homes, stop it. But we didn't. And we have 2.5 million children who will go home out of school, not have a home to go to. 18 million won't have food enough to eat to meet their needs. We have senior citizens eating cat food because they can't afford regular fish. So we're not talking about one homeless person being a measure of a society's contempt for what it represents, but rather a mirror of it. Let's reflect on that. Have a nice day, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow.